Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready to take a bite out of the competition? Are you looking for ideas to make your business better? Welcome to the Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet,
sponsored by Apple Capital Group.
At the core of every successful business, you'll find people making a difference. And with each episode of the Core Business Show, we talk with those people, examine those ideas, and explore the strategies that make them special. Now, the host of the Core Business Show, Tim Jacquet.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host. Thank you for joining the program today. Today, we're going to talk about KGB Enters the Social Network. Our special guest today is Michael R. Davison. He's going to be our guest for the next 20 or 30 minutes, and we're going to talk about the KBG and social network. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can go ahead and pose a question in the chat room or email us at info@thecorebusinessshow.com. Or you can go ahead and call in at 347-324-3460. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tim. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I guess to begin with, our guests love personal stories from our particular guests. And if you don't mind, tell us about yourself, if you don't mind. You can give a minute.
Sure. Some time ago, I took very seriously President Kennedy's admonition to serve our country, and especially his complaint that not enough Americans spoke or understood the Russian language back in the 60s, of course. And so I did study Russian. When I joined the military, I became the translator for the Moscow-Washington hotline at the White House. And after that, my language capabilities attracted the attention of the CIA, and I spent the next 30 years or so as a CIA case officer and senior intelligence officer. 17 of those years were spent abroad chasing Soviets and East Europeans and others in some pretty interesting places, including Warsaw and Cuba. As well as the major European capitals. So I think I got to know the Russians fairly well.
Wow, that's really amazing. You know, we can go back really not too long ago, probably just shy of 20 years when the wall came down, 1989. Kind of tell us where we are, kind of give us a little history for those who don't know. Who is the KGB? And how have things have played out since in the middle of the Cold War from the 60s to the end of the Cold War, as it says, and what we are today? Because are they our biggest enemy in one sense? I mean, we have other countries are bigger threats than Russia, but kind of tell us where we are and kind of give us a history from the 60s and where we are today.
Okay, I'll try.
Okay. Just in a nutshell or something.
You know, there's a bit of controversy today, as a matter of fact, because I believe some of Romney's spokespeople have noted that they consider Russia to be one of the United States' primary enemies, if not the primary enemy. I tend to agree with part of that. I don't think they are the only enemy we have, but if Putin is not inimical towards the United States, he's giving a pretty good imitation of someone who is. Things have changed a bit since the wall came down in November of 1989. You might recall that in 1991, the KGB, headed by Kruchkov at the time, was one of the prime movers in the attempted coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. And as a result of that, not only did the Soviet Union dissolve in 1991, but the KGB was split up into separate parts. So we actually no longer have the KGB. We have the FSB, which is the Internal Security Service, or the Counterintelligence Service of the Russian Federation. And we have the SVR, which is the External Intelligence Service of the Russian Federation. And these are basically the old KGB Department 1 and Department 2 elements. So they have divided up their responsibilities along really traditional lines. And I think if you look back just a couple of years to 2010, when a Russian intelligence defector revealed the existence of a network of Russian illegals in the United States, I think the FBI picked up 10 people who were actually under very deep cover and who'd been sent to the United States, some of them as far back as, at least one as far back as 1985, who were operating as illegal agents of Russian intelligence in this country. So, so things have not changed, you know, things change, but they remain much the same, as the French like to say. And I think that the importance of Russia as an intelligence target for the United States has quite understandably faded a bit in light of all of the other things that have happened in the world since 1991. I remember back in 1990, during that period when things were changing so much in the Soviet Union at that time, with the wall coming down, with Glasnost taking over in the country. People in charge of Soviet East European operations in the CIA decided they didn't want to recruit any more Russians. They were going to be our friends now. And I think there were a lot of people who made the mistake of thinking that, well, if we just help them along and give them some friendly advice, the Russians will just become fat, happy capitalists. And, of course, that did not happen. And that's really one of the reasons I wrote my book, if you want to mention the book before we get into social media. I'd like to say a couple of things here. Number one, there are a lot of espionage-themed novels out there that are written by people who know absolutely nothing about espionage. And so we formed a group, several other former CIA case officers and myself, that we call the Spy Masters Literary Guild to support and promote spy stories written by real spies. My book is entitled Harry's Rules. It's available at Amazon, at my own website, michaelrdavidson.com, and at spymastersguild.com as well. This is a story that I felt was very important because it's based on actual fact, and it's to a certain extent autobiographical. It's a story about the loyalty of a CIA case officer to his agent and the new sources of power in Russia today. Now, in Russia, the seat of power rests on three legs, in my view, and in the view of many others. Those three legs are intelligence, business, and crime. And for much of the time, it's almost impossible to separate the three. You know, Jim Woolsey, the former director of Central Intelligence, noted not too long ago that should you come upon a Russian businessman dressed in a $3,000 suit with a big smile on his face and an engaging manner, you are faced with four possibilities.
Oh, absolutely.
He is what he says he is, a businessman. He's a Russian intelligence officer, or he's part of the Russian mafia. Or the fourth possibility, there's a good chance he's all three. Because that's just the reality in Russia today. You know, at the end of the Cold War, around 1991, possibly in preparation for the coup attempt against Gorbachev, $50 billion mysteriously disappeared from the...
$50 billion?
$50 billion, with a B. So it doesn't seem like much given today's figures, but back in 1991, $50 billion in hard currency was a lot of money, and this represented the entire hard currency reserves of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the Soviet state. Best speculation about this that I've seen is that it was handed over to the KGB for safekeeping. Now, what happened to that $50 billion is really the basis for the plot of my book, Harry's Rules. There was a book written back in 2000 by the editor of Forbes Russia, an American of Russian descent named Paul Klebnikov, in which he described this period of time and what happened with this money and how crime became inextricably intertwined with politics in post-Soviet Russia. Because he knew so much and was writing so much, Paul Klebnikov was shot to death outside his apartment in Moscow 4 years later in 2004. And to this day, no one really knows who killed him, although there you can, you know, make some fairly educated guesses. And which brings us to the subject of social networks in Russia today. You know, if you look around the world right now, social networking is kind of the Paul Revere of modern-day dissent and revolution. Would you kind of agree with that?
Absolutely.
If you look at Egypt, both pre and post so-called Arab Spring, you'll see that social networking played a large role in organizing mass protests. Former Egyptian government was very concerned about this and did a great deal to try to cover what was going on the social networks. The current situation, you have a situation where protests are being directed toward an external target in Egypt, that is the United States. And so the government is actually in that context using the social networks for its own ends. Now, in Russia, the situation is reversed. The networks have been used to organize dissent against the Russian government, and this is something they don't like. So the Russian leadership has seen how effective social networks have been in organizing opposition movements. If you recall, during the Cold War, the Soviets tried to jam the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, and the BBC. But since the disintegration of the Soviet Union in 91, they've sort of lost the monopoly on the dissemination of information. And this does not make them happy campers in the Kremlin. Now we learn that the SVR, if you recall, the SVR is the Foreign Intelligence Service, has acquired some systems that will permit it to not only map social networks, find out who's saying what to whom, and determine the centers of information dissemination throughout the network, but it will eventually permit them to inject their own content into social networks and thereby control it. And deception has been a major weapon of the Russians and the Soviets for a long time. Now, excuse me, in one way, this might be a good thing for dissidents in Russia because it might mean that the Russian government has simply decided to stop killing everybody that disagrees with it. Since 1993, you may not know this, but since 1993, over 300 journalists have been killed in Russia. You might recall the murder of anti-government journalist Anna Politskaya in, October 2006. It received a lot of international attention, which did not please the Kremlin. And then, of course, the even greater notoriety of the murder by polonium poisoning in London of former KGB officer Alexander Litvinenko. If you take a look at Wikipedia, for instance, you can find a list of those killed during the Yeltsin years as well as the Putin years. Until recently, there's been very little retribution against their killers. As a matter of fact, in the 90s, the streets of Moscow resembled the streets of Chicago circa 1929. There were
wow.
Wild shootouts on the streets. Crime was rampant, and it was just not safe to be too outspoken, although a lot of brave people were, and unfortunately died for their beliefs. You know, the elimination of so-called enemies of the state is an old tradition in Russia. The Tsars mm-hmm. used to exile them. The Bolsheviks preferred murder. The Soviet intelligence services, especially the KGB, known as the sword and shield of the party, were the preferred instruments for meting out retribution. And judging from the number of opposition figures who've been killed, the mindset hasn't changed much for the current occupants of the Kremlin. But with social networking, which means, you know, you can't identify one or two people or a specific journalist, you have vast swaths of the public who have cell phones, who have computers, who have access to information, and they just decided, you know, unlike Stalin, who didn't blink at murdering 30 or 40 million of his citizens, the current occupants of the Kremlin have decided they really can't just kill everybody, so they're going to try to control them through through rather devious means.
Let's take a break real quick, and we're going to come
sure.
back with the conversation. We'll be back in one moment. You listen to The Core Business Show. I'm Tim Jacquet, your host.
You're listening to The Core Business Show, sponsored by Apple Capital Group. Apple Capital Group in Jacksonville, Florida is a commercial lender that specializes in asset-based loans, equipment leasing and financing, invoice financing, commercial real estate loans, and asset-based financing in the U.S. and Canada. Apple Capital Group is a direct lender that lends on their private equity investment portfolio. 90% of most loans are decided within 2 hours, and vendor funding within 24 hours after documents are completed with a one-page application. No slow no's, just a quick decision and a fast yes. To get more information about lending from Apple Capital Group, call 866-611-7457. That's 866-611-7457 to speak with one of our loan specialists. Or visit us right now at applecapitalgroup.com. Welcome back to The Core. Once again, here's Tim Jacquet.
Well, welcome back to the program. Again, our topic is the KGB enters the social network. My special guest today is Michael R. Davison, and he is also an author of a book as well. I guess go ahead and continue with the conversation you just had before we went on break.
Sure. Seems like I was talking an awful lot, but I'll be glad to continue. I mentioned Paul Klebnikov, who was murdered in Moscow in 2004. As a matter of fact, I dedicate this book in part to him because it's his book which actually inspired the plot for mine. You know, it's often said that truth is stranger than fiction. And in many ways, my book, Harry's Rules, is an attempt to convey a warning to readers in a form more palatable than nonfiction.
Okay.
And so using the example I just gave of the missing $50 billion in Soviet hard currency, I asked the question, did the Cold War end or did the KGB find a way to retain power and to dominate the new Russian Federation? And my answer to that question, of course, is yes. You know, there's a book that's come out recently by a British analyst of things Russian called Edward Lucas. And in this book, I was quite surprised, actually, to note the parallels between his book and my own. He says, if I may paraphrase that, in no other country, talking about Russia, in no other country have gangsterdom and state power overlapped to such a threatening extent. You know, the most powerful drug cartels may have high-tech communications equipment or the ability to penetrate a law enforcement agency or have some politicians on the payroll, but they have nothing that yet matches Russia's ruling criminal syndicate's capabilities. It has almost limitless money, global geographical scope, and the full armory of state technical and logistical resources, from spy satellites to submarines, giving unprecedented capabilities in snooping and manipulation. The name of Lucas's book, by the way, is Deception, The Untold Story of East-West Espionage Today. And I highly recommend it to one and all. It was recently reviewed in the Wall Street Journal very favorably. Now, that should make people stop and pause for a moment. If and put yourself in the shoes of a, say, a criminal kingpin, whose natural enemy, of course, is the state and the police forces of the state, but who suddenly has at his disposal not only the willing collaboration of the police forces, but the collaboration of the intelligence services, the use of diplomatic pouches, information collected by electronic means by your equivalent of the National Security Agency. Just think how profitable and useful that would be to a criminal organization, and then how the criminalization of Russia seems to have taken place. So that's, I think, in many ways what we're facing today when we look at Russia. You know, Russia is, of course, by far not the biggest immediate threat to the United States, but let's just take one example. You recall how back in the early 90s, when business dealings were embargoed against Saddam Hussein's Iraq, it was discovered that the Russian energy industry, I think it was Rosneft, had some $500 million invested in the Iraqi oil industry. Now, when we went into Iraq, both times, we were accused worldwide of being after the oil. That's about all I heard when I spoke with my friends in other countries. But if you look at the results today, ExxonMobil's getting out of Iraq, and the Russians, Gazprom and Rosneft, are buying up huge concessions all over the Middle East, including Iraq, where they will basically, I think, eventually control the petroleum industry. One of the reasons we find Putin working against our interests, or at least what we perceive as our interests in Syria today, and defending the current Syrian regime, is that one of the ways they're going to get that energy out of the Middle East to avoid the Straits of Hormuz is via a pipeline through Syria, which already has a small pipeline coming from Iraq, I believe, and for several years there's been talk of the construction of a large capacity pipeline from Kirkuk in Syria out through to a Syrian port. So, you know, when you look at motivations for why the Russians are perfectly happy to allow the current regime to continue slaughtering its own people in Syria, it gets back to economics and to Russia's desire to control the energy supplies for especially Western Europe. Which gives them considerable leverage over Western Europe.
Well, absolutely. So why – I know there's hatred to the United States, but why is this same is not really geared towards Russia? I mean, they just – I guess if you just allow us to do our thing and Russia will slowly come in and take over and quietly, but – they don't see them as a threat or at all?
I certainly hope that we have smart people in government and especially in our intelligence services. We have a president who unfortunately doesn't seem to pay a lot of attention to intelligence since he has missed over half of the briefings that presidents are entitled to. Certainly we're distracted by events in the Middle East, which have to take precedence because those are people who are trying to kill us. The Russians are playing, I think, a much more clever game. They're playing the long game, not the short game. And they will, I believe, do what they can to thwart our interests in the Middle East, keep us distracted there as long as they possibly can while they continue to make gains. You know, I worry about things like having backed down from the Russians on the question of defensive missile capability in Eastern Europe, in Poland and Czechoslovakia. I worry about the fact that we have signed a nuclear weapons reduction agreement, a new one with the Russians, which I believe puts us at a strategic disadvantage because no matter what anybody says about the numbers of warheads, if we don't spend the money to modernize them and maintain them, they're not going to do us much good when and if the time comes.
Absolutely.
We've already lost $500 billion from the defense budget, and with sequestration being threatened, that's another half a trillion. We have an administration which has decided to abandon 70 years of U.S. policy to be able to have the capability to fight a war on two fronts in favor of a new strategy, if you want to call it that, retain the capability to fight only one war at a time. The United States has an obligation in the world. Our role as a superpower is a very important one because we basically keep the peace. Many people don't understand that. They see our power as a threat. What I see our power as is a counterbalance to centrifugal forces out there that are trying to tear the world apart. And given what's happening now, I'm fairly pessimistic about what's going to happen in the future. The Middle East is it's been for centuries, since the 7th century, since before that, a source of great divisiveness in the world. It's the home of the three major monotheistic religions of the world, and ironically enough, that fact causes tremendous discord. And I don't see much happening right now to prevent a horrible disaster from occurring in the Middle East in the not-too-distant future.
Well, real quick, because we're almost out of time, what would you like to leave us with, probably within about 30 seconds?
I'd like for people to buy my book.
Okay. Just
to reiterate, the title of the book is Harry's Rules. It's
okay.
Available at Amazon.com in both hard copy and Kindle editions, or through my website, MichaelRDavidson.com, or the SpyMastersGuild.com website.
Great. Well, Michael, I really appreciate you joining the show, and I'm going to kind of reach out and take a look at the book. Thank you. Thank you for joining
the
program.
Thank you so much. I appreciate
it. Take care.
Take care, Tim.
Okay, bye-bye. Again, it's been another production of The Core Business Show. Thank you for listening. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet. For a free quote on equipment leasing and financing, visit our website, applecapitalgroup.com. That's applecapitalgroup.com. And fill out the information to receive your free quote. We hope you'll join us for our next episode. And remember, you can always get to The Core via iTunes. You'll find all our previous episodes there. Thanks again for listening to The Core Business Show with Tim Jacquet.